Welcome back to the London Architect podcast. My name is Lily Patience and I'm your host. On the London Architect, we get the chance to interview some really interesting individuals and discuss the world of architecture and design in London and beyond, I think, especially with our guest today, Claire Lutzo. Claire is a soul practitioner. She specialises in period properties and energy retrofitting, and she's based in Kent. Right, Claire?
Yeah. That's
but you right. haven't yeah. always been based in Kent because you're from Reading.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I grew up in Reading and after a short stint in Nottingham at university, ended up in London. And from there, I now practice out of Orpington. Most of my clients are based in Kent and Sevenoaks and Tunbridge Wells, that kind of area.
And it's a really beautiful area to work in, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's lovely. And there are a lot of heritage buildings and listed properties, which is great because that's what I'm really interested in.
And it must be like gorgeous on a day like today and like the past week. I just want to be outside all the time. I mean, how much time are you spending out on site?
Depending on the stage that my projects are at. And when the project is on site, I can be going once a week or once a fortnight and spending a whole day on site, which is not great when it's cold and and everything's outside and the roof's off. But on days like today, on beautiful sunny kind of spring mornings, it's pretty lovely.
Yeah, I can imagine. So Claire, would you like to start by giving us a run through of your career journey so far and some key moments in there?
Yeah, I guess I fell into architecture. It was never really something I set out to be. I ended up studying for A-level English, maths and art, and not really knowing where that was going to lead me. I knew that I wanted to go to university, and I've got four brothers, two older brothers, and I visited them at uni and knew that that was something I wanted to do. And really, I only cottoned on to architecture because a careers advisor at school was trying to figure out what you can do at university when you studied English, maths and art at A-level. And they just suggested, architecture seems to fit. I obviously started to learn about the training journey to become an architect, which is quite a long one.
Yeah.
And promptly told the careers advisor that there's no way I wanted to go through all of that. And they found a course which was called Architectural Studies. Mm-hmm. And said, this is just a course for 3 years, undergraduate degree. You can go and learn about architecture. And then I thought from that point, I'll have a kind of design and creative background and maybe I'll go into advertising or something else. So I went to Nottingham University to do my undergraduate. And the first year of the course just happened to be identical between the architectural studies course I was on and the part one architecture training. And at the end of that first year, my tutor pulled me to one side and said, the bits that you're good at are the bits that are the training to be an architect. Mm. And the rest of your course, from where the two courses diverge, is going to be sitting in lectures writing essays. That's not your strong suit. Yes. So I promptly stepped over to the full architecture, the part one course, and just really enjoyed it. So I think from that point, I was still very reticent to keep going and do the full training. So I took a couple of years out after that undergraduate degree, thought about other directions I could go in, went travelling.
Where did you go travelling?
I went to Australia and Southeast Asia.
Oh, nice.
I went to Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, and it was amazing. And when I came back, I looked at getting a job doing something else, and it was easiest to get a job in an architecture practice. So I did a bit more experience working in an architect's practice.
Yeah.
And from then on, realised that I had to keep going and go back to university because I did want to become an architect.
Yeah, so this is really great because it's almost like you spoke at the beginning about how it's a bit daunting.
And then
you've done half of it without realising. And is the architectural studies degree still available?
I imagine it would be. Yeah. And I think it's quite clever that the two different degrees start off the same way. There was somebody who swapped the other direction. Mm. So there was somebody else who went from the full architecture course onto the architectural studies. So I think at that age, I mean, you don't know.
That's a bit more. You were stepping up to doing something more hardcore.
I guess so.
Commitment. So tell us, what happened next?
Between the part one and the part two, I moved to London and I worked in a range of different practices. I started off in a really large architecture practice called PRP. Mm-hmm. And we were working on massive developments or new build developments of social housing.
Yeah.
The practice does all sorts of things, but that was the area that I fell into at that point. And then afterwards, I ended up working on the completely other end of the scale for a tiny architecture practice, which mm-hmm. was just a husband and wife team and me.
Yeah.
And got some experience of working on internal refits for Selfridges and yeah. for art exhibitions, just literally on the complete opposite end of the scale.
Did you feel any more valued in a smaller team than to
I mean the those two companies were almost incomparable. The experience was so different. So in the larger practice, and especially because I was on the very bottom rung of the ladder, I was exposed to a lot. So I felt like I was learning a lot about the technology that I needed to learn.
Yeah.
But I was basically going in and doing the same thing every day. So there was a lot of sitting at a computer screen okay. and not as much getting out onto site and being in meetings as I would have enjoyed.
Yeah.
But when I worked for the much smaller practice, I was involved with everything, not just on the architecture side of things, but also on how the practice ran.
Can I just add, this is so random, but I just realised I've worked for PRP as a receptionist for a little bit.
Really?
I went away traveling. I had like,
wow.
It was like a month or so where they needed somebody and I worked there. Yeah, really random.
Wow.
I definitely didn't learn as much as you did.
Yeah.
Anyway, but then after working at those two practices, you went to a third one, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. So then I ended up in a company that was at the time called Bush O'Henley, and mm-hmm. it's actually gone through a couple of name changes, and now it's Henley Hale Brown.
Yeah.
And that was a medium-sized company, so there was about 20 of us in the office. And they work on much more kind of community-led projects. They also do social housing, and they do healthcare buildings and town halls. And I guess I was more involved with the social housing side of things, because that's the experience that I'd brought from PRP. Okay. And I ended up staying there through my part three and gaining my full qualifications and becoming a project architect on social housing schemes.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel like you've almost taken something with you from each of those?
Yeah, I think so. And I think moving on to becoming a sole practitioner, the experience that I had working at the tiny practice was really important to feel like it was possible to make it all work when there's so few of you, and to be involved with all the different elements of running a business, not just the architecture.
Yeah. So next, you started your own practice.
Again, I guess I kind of fell into this as well. But after having children, I wanted to work part-time. And it wasn't so easy to be a part-time project architect in a medium-sized practice, because they really wanted the projects to be led by the full-time members of the staff.
Yeah.
So I took a little bit of a step back when I went back part-time, and it wasn't as fulfilling, and I didn't want to increase my hours and be full-time, because the demands on being a mum of very small children and being expected to be in an office, and there being no flexibility for if the children were unwell and I had to take time and all the rest, it was a difficult juggle. So I decided to try being a sole practitioner and see if I could make a role that worked around the lifestyle that I wanted. And I thought, I'll just give it a couple of years and see what happens.
Yeah.
And I've been doing it now for 12 years and it's all working out pretty good. I found that working from home and running my own practice, especially at the start when I was working on fairly small jobs for domestic clients,
it was
probably easier than I thought it was going to be
to
manage around a small family, and being able to have that kind of ultimate flexibility. The job really, it could handle that. It worked really well.
Yeah.
And I was also able to take on more clients and take on bigger jobs as the children have got older and I've got more time to spend on the career. I've been able to kind of grow the practice. And so it's been quite a journey.
Yeah.
And now I've become a lot more specialised in working with older buildings, which has been a real kind of passion of mine and real interest. I also live in an old building, and so I think you gain an awful lot of knowledge when you actually living day to day with the decisions that you're telling your clients to make. But really, I found that the knowledge as a mother, because I'm working with domestic clients that have their own families, you can bring an awful lot to the table if you understand the way that your client lives and the way they use their house and how that's going to change as the children grow older.
Yeah.
So like you were saying, most of the clients that you're speaking to, it's actually it's the woman, it's the wife, she's the person who's your kind of key contact between the client. And so it's really good for me to be able to have a lot to bring to the table for my own personal knowledge and experience, not just as an architect, but as a mum.
And how that space is going to be used by the family,
and how it adapts and how your house has to change as your children grow. A lot of people are very focused on right now we've got young children and this is what we need.
It's quite a bittersweet like perspective to have on it, and I guess as somebody coming in and giving advice and designing, you are able to look at it from like a bird's eye view and see this is what your house is going to look like over the progression of you living here.
Absolutely. It's nice to be able to take your client and kind of zoom out a little bit and look at the future of the house, not just what you need right now.
So obviously we've discussed your role as a mother in the industry, but I thought even broader than that, what about your perspective on the industry as a woman? Because obviously architecture is very male dominated. And I did a little bit of research last night. I thought it was interesting that in 2023, 31% of architects were women, and there was still a gender pay gap of 16%.
Yeah.
If you're a sole practitioner, the gender pay gap doesn't apply to that, I'm guessing. Like, well, how does it? Is that just within practices?
It's an interesting question. I guess it does apply if women are underselling themselves, if women are asking for a lower fee from their clients because they don't feel able to ask for more, or they lack the confidence to be able to say, I'm worth this, which is maybe a characteristic that men are better at that than women. So I guess it probably does still ring true in the, it's not as direct a comparison to make that two people are working in the same practice and the woman is earning less. But I think it might be true that women are putting together lower fee proposals. There are definitely less women working in architecture than there should be, especially when I first started my undergraduate degree. My course was 50-50 boys and girls, and it was the first year that Nottingham University had that kind of equality. However, as you go up through the system, the women are dropping out. So when I got to part two, it was no longer 50-50, and then you get into the workforce and there are less and less women, and I'm sure there's many reasons. It's difficult to go on such a long training journey to become fully qualified, to put all of that time in with the view of then I'm going to take a few years out and have a family. It's potentially more attractive to do something where you can be fully qualified and earning a decent wage for a length of time before you take that career break. Although working in architecture, really literally from your part one year out, you are doing the job of an architect and learning those skills. So actually the rubber stamp end qualification is not that meaningful, because what you do on a day-to-day basis doesn't change because of that. It just develops over the course of all of the experience that you're gaining.
We spoke a bit before about your experience of being a young woman and having to go to site and stuff. What is your experience of that?
So building sites are still overwhelmingly male. I've worked once with a female decorator and once with a female plumber, but really all the trades that I've worked with other than that in the last decade have been men. So there is an element of building site being a fairly kind of testosterone fueled environment. And I had one experience when I was very young where the site manager was obviously really put off the fact that the lead architect was a young woman. And he did take the mick out of the high-vis jacket that was an extra large size. They gave me a hat that was way too big, that's wobbling on the top of my head. And it's really easy for that kind of bullying mentality to feed into it. However, I mean, that was an experience I had 15 years ago. Generally, I think even though the building sites are still majority male, I have found that the reception that I get by contractors is really positive. And I've had a few experiences recently where contractors have come to me and said, you know, do you know what? I don't know what that is. You put this on this drawing and I don't understand it. I've never used this before. Can we kind of talk about it? Mm. And then after we've had that conversation, they've said to me, do you know what, when I've worked with male architects, I would have basically tried to fake it or just, you know. And
really?
I wouldn't have felt comfortable enough to have admitted, I'm not sure about that and can we discuss it in more detail? And I think that they're really actually highlighting the positives of having women come onto the building site and it does change maybe slightly the status quo.
That definitely highlights the positives of being a female in the industry. I was wondering if now you'd like to tell us a little bit about the sort of areas that you specialise in.
So I guess my typical client is somebody who has a listed property or an older built property and wants to look at the energy efficiency and the quality of the building. Maybe there are areas that need a bit of work or need a bit of maintenance. And so I will typically go in and have a look and discuss with them the renovation work that needs to be done to just bring the building back to its kind of best condition. And then also there's usually a little bit of remodeling. Quite often older buildings have evolved kind of over time and had extensions and extensions added onto extensions and don't really function in their layout particularly well. Also quite a lot of beautiful older properties just don't have the spaces that we're used to using or we're expecting to have in our homes at this point.
Yeah.
And so extending and providing something which has maybe a bit more of a contemporary feel, has a bit more open space that we can't provide within the original building.
Yeah, and then I'm guessing those are the most problematic buildings in terms of energy efficiency as well.
Yeah, I'm keen to encourage my clients to actually look at improving and doing as much as they can to create a much more efficient building, all working with the traditional fabric and all the rest.
I mean, did you learn about this during your degree or like when you kind of went into it and specialised in it? Did that involve a lot of research on your part?
The university courses do cover the kind of history of architecture and traditional buildings, but it's not something that I remember them dwelling on in any. So really what I've learned has been on the job.
Yeah.
And also because it was an interest of mine, the first property that I moved into with my now husband, then boyfriend, was an older building.
Yeah.
And we ended up doing little bits of renovation ourselves and reglazing windows and taking all the old sashes apart. And that was just something that we were both really quite interested in.
Yeah.
And now I live in a Grade II listed Georgian farmhouse and I've gone back to university to study other courses in order to kind of upskill myself because this is something that I want to do more of.
So that's my dream, to live in a house like that. Can't beat them for charm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But there are drawbacks, aren't there, with energy efficiency and
ghosts.
I've actually got witch marks and in the basement of our house. They used to chisel these symbols into, especially at the chimneys, because the witches could come down the chimneys. So they protect you by chiseling these symbols into your chimney breasts. And our chimneys drop all the way down into the cellar. So we found these witch marks.
Oh, that's creepy.
In the cellar on the breast in order to protect our house from witches. So there you go.
Nation.
Yeah.
People.
Yeah.
She believed witches.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
Anyway, I would like to hear about the old post office, please.
So the old post office is a project that is currently on site. My client bought this beautiful building that was originally a post office with some accommodation for the postmaster out back. It was built in 1845 and then in 1980, it became converted. The post office left and it was converted fully into a house.
Okay.
The building is, it like many older buildings, has been kind of patched up over time, not very sympathetically, using more modern building materials. And that's often a big problem. So the house was suffering with some damp issues and structural issues and all quite common complaints of living in an older building. So we're currently doing quite a lot of remedial work. The roof has come off and we're retiling the roof and stripping back lots of plaster work so that we can put it back in permeable lime plaster. And then the next phase of the project, we are just hoping to get planning permission next week, we find out, for two extensions to the property. And one is replacing a conservatory off the rear, and the other is an outbuilding, an annex in the grounds of the post office, which originally was a bakery and has been much neglected. And we are going to be extending that so that the owner has a study office space and a bit more accommodation for the family to use.
So going back to what you just said about damp problems, could you explain that in a little bit more detail in terms of like why this is a problem for older properties?
So if the old building is working well and hasn't been recovered with non-breathable materials, then the lime plaster can literally absorb. So if you've got excess humidity in the room, that the materials have a certain hygroscopic effect that they can actually absorb some of that moisture. The real problem in older buildings at the moment is that the way we live now, we eject a huge amount more moisture into the buildings than anybody did when they were built. So we are taking more showers and baths, and people are washing a lot more, people are cooking a lot more, people are cooking in the house when originally they would have been
cooking outside,
you know, cooking in different areas, and now we're and also you know, we're boiling the kettle, and we're drying our clothes inside the house. It's a huge amount. There's a huge amount of moisture that we're introducing into the buildings, but we're no longer lighting a fire, and we no longer have lovely rickety old windows that we don't really close properly, and we don't have that kind of through draft, and we're not comfortable in buildings that are drafty.
Yeah.
So so there's a problem, and to a certain extent, if you're living in an older building and if you're living in a modern building, you need to be really mindful of how much moisture you're putting into the building.
So obviously there you're sort of looking at the energy efficiency of the house while it's in use. But also before that, you kind of bear in mind the embodied carbon in those processes. So could you explain that a little bit to some of our audience?
So the kind of attitudes that we've had over the past few years about trying to make our buildings more energy efficient has all been about wrapping them in insulation and using really hyper efficient thermal products, which are actually, they're all derived from petrochemicals. So they're actually, they're not green products, but what they're doing to your building is making your building a lot more energy efficient. So that's been kind of the focus. It's been on the thermal improvement. So now people are a lot more mindful of the carbon that goes into creating the materials in its manufacture, and then also the transport, the carbon in the transport, bring it to site, and all of these things, they have to become more important. So actually, a lot of people who are now trying to build with more natural materials are looking at the materials that we used to build our buildings with. So, you know, hay, straw, as an insulant and as a building material is come back, and using wood fibre for insulation. I mean, obviously at the extreme end of scale, sheep's wool insulation, all these things, but all these natural materials, I'm looking at my older buildings and they've all been used before. Like we've come full circle. There is a meeting point between these things. So you can build a passive house using natural materials. Mm. It is possible to get the kind of the thermal performance that you need and the air tightness and all these things with a straw-built, you know, straw-built system. The difficulty is that there are so many different ways to create an energy efficient or a low carbon building. And the thing that I think the industry has been struggling with is a lack of focus. Yeah. So some people are much more interested in creating like a super insulated and a super airtight building.
Yeah.
Other people are interested in how the materials are sourced and where they come from and where is it mined and how is it transported to site. Really more interested in sourcing local materials. And then other people are looking at the carbon content of the things they're putting into the house. And I think that it's time for all these different bits of research and all these different bits of knowledge to be pulled together. Mm. And there is a net zero carbon buildings standard, yeah. which currently is just kind of a guidance document that people can refer to and use in order to show that their buildings are achieving net zero. But this document pulls together all these different strands of embodied carbon and carbon in use. And it will become mandatory in the future. It's something that we all have to anticipate. Yeah. But I guess that's a really good first step forward for the industry to actually all have one standard document which shows these are the important bits, these are the bits to follow, and this is how you
agree on an opinion.
Yeah.
That's how the process should be.
Yeah,
I mean, that really ties in, because I was going to ask you about what you think the future of the industry is, but do you think that's something that we can expect in the next sort of 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I think that everything will start to pull together now. Yeah. The REBA has the 2030 climate challenge, which is really encouraging architects to aim. Obviously, 2030 is really just around the corner.
Yeah, actually.
And achieving net zero by 2050, which is the government's challenge, is it's going to be a huge challenge for the whole industry. At the moment, we're not making anywhere near the kind of progress that we need to. Mm. So hopefully things are going to start pulling together now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, Claire. It's been fantastic. We've covered a lot of stuff. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as we have.
Yeah,
we've got very involved today.
It's been lovely. It's been really good fun.
Good. I'm glad. So for our listeners, I want to say a big thank you for listening again. And as always, please tune in on Spotify and YouTube. And you can follow us on LinkedIn and get all of the latest updates on there. So thank you very much, Claire. Thank you very much, audience. And we'll see you all next time on The London Architect. Bye-bye.